Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in a year. In a year. Oh gosh. I got that wrong. It's only the 360-somethingth time I've said it, and I messed it up. Anyway, epilogue 2, chapter 8, here we go. If history dealt with external phenomena, the establishment of this simple and obvious law would suffice, and we should have finished our argument. But the law of history relates to a man. A particle of matter cannot tell us that it does not feel the law of attraction or repulsion, and that that law is untrue. But man, who is the subject of history, says plainly, I am free and am therefore not the subject of the law. The presence of the problem of man's free will, though unexpressed, is felt at every step of history. All seriously thinking historians have involuntarily encountered this question. All the contradictions and obscurities of history and the false path historical science has followed are due solely to the lack of a solution of that question. If the will of every man were free, that is, if each man could act as he pleased, all history would be a series of disconnected accidents. If, in 1,000 years, even one man, in 1,000,000, could act freely, that is, as he chose, it is evident that one single free act of that man's, in violation of the laws governing human action, would destroy the possibility of the existence of any laws for the whole of humanity. If there be a single law governing the actions of men, free will cannot exist, for man's will would be subject to that law. In this contradiction lies the problem of free will, which from most ancient times has occupied the best human minds, and from most ancient times has been presented in its whole tremendous significance. The problem is that regarding man as a subject of observation, from whatever point of view, theological, historical, ethical, or philosophic, we find a general law of necessity to which he, like all that exists, is subject. But regarding him from within ourselves as what we are conscious of, we feel ourselves to be free. This consciousness is a source of self-cognition, quite apart from and independent of reason. Through his reason, man observes himself, but only through consciousness does he know himself. Apart from consciousness of self, no observation or application of reason is conceivable. To understand, observe, and draw conclusions, man must first of all be conscious of himself as living. A man is only conscious of himself as a living being by the fact that he wills, that is conscious of his volition. But his will, which forms the essence of his life, man recognizes and can only recognize as being free. If observing himself, man sees that his will is always directed by one and the same law, whether he observes the necessity of taking food, using his brain, or anything else, he cannot recognize this never-varying direction of his will otherwise than as a limitation of it. Were it not free, it could not be limited. A man's will seems to him to be limited, just because he is not conscious of it except as free. You say, I am not free, but I have lifted my hand and let it fall. Everyone understands that this illogical reply is an irrefutable demonstration of freedom. That reply is the expression of a consciousness that is not subject to reason. If the consciousness of freedom were not a separate and independent source of self-consciousness, it would be subject to reasoning and to experience. But in fact, such subjection does not exist and is inconceivable. A series of experiments and arguments proves to every man that he, as an object of observation, is subject to certain laws, and man submits to them and never resists the laws of gravity or impermeability, once he has become acquainted with them. But the same series of experiments and arguments proves to him that the complete freedom of which he is conscious in himself is impossible, and that his every action depends on his organization, his character and the motives acting upon him. Yet man never submits to the deductions of these experiments and arguments. Having learnt from experiment and argument that a stone falls downward, a man indubitably believes this and always expects the law he has learnt to be fulfilled. But learning just as certainly that his will is subject to laws, he does not and cannot believe it. However often experiment and reasoning may show a man that under the same condition and with the same character he will do the same thing as before, yet when under the same conditions and with the same character he approaches for the 1,000th time the action that always ends in the same way, he feels as certainly convinced as before the experiment that he can act as he pleases. Every man, savage or sage, however, incontestably reason and experiment may prove to him that it is impossible to imagine two different courses of action in precisely the same conditions, feels that without this irrational conception, which constitutes the essence of freedom, he cannot imagine life. He feels that, however impossible it may be, it is so, for without this conception of freedom, not only would he be unable to understand life, but he would be unable to live for a single moment. He could not live because all man's efforts, all his impulses to life, are only efforts to increase freedom. Wealth and poverty, fame and obscurity, power and subordination, strength and weakness, health and disease, culture and ignorance, work and leisure, repletion and hunger, virtue and vice are only greater or lesser degrees of freedom. A man having no freedom cannot be conceived of except as deprived of life. If the conception of freedom appears to reason a senseless contradiction, like the possibility of performing two actions at one and the same instant of time, or of an effect without a cause, that only proves that consciousness is not subject to reason. This unshakable, irrefutable consciousness of freedom, uncontrolled by experiment or argument, recognized by all thinkers and felt by everyone without exception, this consciousness without which no conception of man is possible, constitutes the other side of the question. Man is the creation of an all-powerful, all-good, and all-seeing God. What is sin, the conception of which arises from the consciousness of man's freedom? That is the question for theology. The actions of men are subject to general immutable laws expressed in statistics. What is man's responsibility to society, the conception of which results from the conception of freedom? That is the question for jurisprudence. Man's actions proceed from his innate character and the motives acting upon him. What is conscience and the perception of right and wrong in actions that follows from the consciousness of freedom? That is the question for ethics. Man, in connection with the general life of humanity, appears subject to laws which determine that life, but the same man, apart from that connection, appears to be free. How should the past life of nations and humanity be regarded? As the result of the free, or as the result of the constrained activity of man? That is the question for history. Only in our self-confident day of the popularization of knowledge, thanks to that most powerful engine of ignorance, the diffusion of printed matter, has the question of the freedom of will been put on a level on which the question itself cannot exist. In our time, the majority of so-called advanced people, that is, the crowd of ignoramuses, has taken the work of the naturalists who deal with one side of the question for a solution of the whole problem. They say and write and print that the soul and freedom do not exist, for the life of man is expressed by muscular movements, and muscular movements are conditioned by the activity of the nerves. The soul and free will do not exist because at an unknown period of time we sprang from the apes. They say this not at all suspecting that thousands of years ago the same law of necessity, which with such ardour they are now trying to prove by physiology and comparative zoology, was not merely acknowledged by all the religions and all the thinkers, but has never been denied. They do not see that the role of the natural sciences in this matter is merely to serve as an instrument for the illumination of one side of it. for the fact that from the point of view of observation, reason and the will are merely secretions of the brain, and that man, following the general law, may have developed from lower animals at some unknown period of time, only explains from a fresh side the truth admitted thousands of years ago by all the religious and philosophic theories, that from the point of view of reason, man is subject to the law of necessity, but it does not advance by a hair's breadth the solution of the question, which has another opposite side based on the consciousness of freedom. If men descended from apes at an unknown period of time, that is as comprehensible as that they were made from a handful of earth at a certain period of time. In the first case, the unknown quantity is the time. In the second case, it is the origin. And the question of how man's consciousness of freedom is to be reconciled with the laws of necessity to which he is subject cannot be solved by comparative physiology and zoology, for in a frog, a rabbit, and an ape, we can observe only the muscular nervous activity. But in man we can observe consciousness as well as the muscular and nervous activity. The naturalists and their followers, thinking they can solve this question, are like plasterers set to plaster one side of the walls of a church, who, availing themselves of the absence of the chief superintendent of the work, should, in an excess of zeal, plaster over the windows, icons, woodwork, and still unbuttressed walls, and should be delighted that from their point of view, as plasterers, everything is now so smooth and regular. Alright, there we go, another chapter down, another tirade of ranting from Tolstoy, but you know what? I didn't mind this one. Tirade might be a bit harsh. What does tirade even mean? Tirade, is that even a word? It's one of those words that when you say it, it just sounds wrong now. Tirade. Tirade.
Tirade.
A long, angry speech of criticism or accusation. There you go. It wasn't such a tirade. It wasn't too repetitive, this one, and it wasn't too on the nose. I didn't mind it. I actually didn't mind it. I didn't really agree with it, but I enjoyed reading this. That's a pleasant surprise. I didn't think I was going to enjoy any part of the second epilogue because you know, I haven't enjoyed it much so far. And leading up to it all year long, I was reading comments about how bad the second epilogue is. Original CJ5 said, I had to skip the last few chapters out of free will and necessity. I might even skip to the end of the book out of free will and necessity. I wonder if Tolstoy wrote this epilogue out of his free will and necessity. That's funny. Chattelbelster said, the longer I read your comment, the more it seems that you've posted this out of necessity instead of freedom. Original CJ5 said, I started the book out of freedom, but completing it is more a necessity than free will. Sonic Vroom said, I fell behind when exams started. He is hoping we can finish the book by free will and necessity. Original CJ5 said, you didn't miss much. Well, I think I'm loving all these comments about the struggle to get through just these last 12 chapters. That's really all it is, isn't it? Well, at least for my part. I liked the first epilogue. There was a few chapters that were a bit ranty, but I liked it. This one, yeah. I can see why it gets a lot of flack. Lucky number 7 Watt said, I'm really struggling to read the second epilogue properly without just skimming it. The first epilogue was a nice catch-up of what the characters got up to after the end, but the boring, painful Tolstoy ranting about historians and free will in the second epilogue is doing my head in and leaving a bad taste in my mouth. I tend to zone out with the free will versus determinism argument. I don't know why. I just think it's been done to death is what I think it is. And I feel like I've got a pretty good understanding of it. I've considered it at length. I spent a long time thinking about that question. And I don't know, for me that whole matter is sort of settled in my mind. And so I don't know, I just don't get much out of discussing it. hope that doesn't sound like I'm closed off to it. Like I've got it sorted out, so let's stop talking about it. It's not like that. It's just that whenever the subject comes up again, I'm all ears, but I just don't get anything out of it. Anyway, I've got the feeling we're going to have a few more chapters on free will versus determinism coming up, because it's not like Tolstoy to sort of broach a topic and then just let it go. So I feel like throughout the rest of these last five chapters, or however many there is, how many is there? Three chapters? What is there? Wait, is there three chapters left? There's three Oh my god, there's three chapters left. Wait, let me confirm that. Chapter 9, 10, 11. Oh, there's four chapters left. My apologies, four chapters left. That is not a lot. That's not much. Anyway, I think in those four chapters we're going to hear more about this argument. So I'm not going to dive in and discuss it on a deeper level. Firstly, because it's difficult to discuss. It's just so, like, confusing, right? It just makes your head spin a little bit. Secondly, because, like I said, whenever the topic comes up and I do engage in it, I don't get much out of it. I kind of come back out where I was to begin with. And finally, because I feel like it's going to be coming up again tomorrow and the next day or at some point. So if we talk about it in depth now, we'll be completely sick of the subject in a few days. I hope that makes sense. All right. Hey, four more chapters. Three more days. I'm going to fit two of those chapters in one day. So we're 3 days away. Is that right? Yeah, it's the 28th of December here in Australia right now. And we are on track to finish on New Year's. Wow, that's exciting. Around that time, I think there's going to be a few podcasts in pretty quick succession. Because we're going to have the New Year's. We're going to have the final chapter. And I think I'm going to have to do another episode after the final chapter, like a wrap-up thing, right? Like a congratulations episode. That just seems like it has to happen. Then, similarly, I think we need to do a bit of an introduction episode for the Hemingway list. Actually, maybe I'll mix those together. No, I won't, because you know what will happen is some people are just tuning in now to start the podcast with the Hemingway list, so they haven't come from A Year of War and Peace. So if I do a wrap-up episode, I don't want them to have to listen to that, because it might be spoilers for War and Peace, which they'll eventually read. So I'll have to keep them separate. I'm just thinking out loud here. So there'll be a wrap-up episode for War and Peace, there'll be an introduction episode for the Hemingway list, and then chapter one of the Hemingway list. Although, you know what, we can probably mix those together. The introduction, and then at the end of it, I'll read the first chapter. Yep, that's what I'll do. That is what I'll do. I'm glad we sorted that out. Anyway, regardless, that means there's going to be three episodes over the course of 2 days in that case as well. There's going to be lots of episodes flying your way. I'll try to keep them relatively short, though, I suppose. Is that what people want? Maybe not. I mean, you're here to listen, so the podcasts I listen to go for 2 hours and 3 hours sometimes, so maybe I shouldn't have to bother with trying to make them short. In saying that, I am rambling at the moment, so I'm going to keep this episode short and wrap it up right now. Thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.